Hello, everybody. It's 2:00, so I'm going to go ahead and get us started. We are waiting for Ellie, the Chair of the HCBR. She should be here any minute. I'm not sure if the Chair of the HPC is going to make it or not. I think that's the only missing stakeholder. Does anybody see anybody missing? HSF, Beehive, DNA, Chamber, oh, and somebody else is missing. Sorry. Anybody notice who it is? Anywho, I'm going to start by introducing myself and the staff that's in the room, and then I'm going to have you all introduce yourselves, one to each other, but two to everybody else. This is a little bit different than how we normally do a stakeholder meeting, mostly because we wanted to record it, and we had to get you up on the microphones up at the dais to be able to record you. So just a little tutorial. Press the button on the right to turn on your mic. When it's red, it's working. I think it's the right button. Is that correct? Can somebody press it and see if the light comes up? Okay. Yes, the button on the right. This one here, it'll light up. Oh, yep. So when you want to talk, you press that and talk. All right, so I'll go first. I'm Leah Mihalik. I'm Director of Historic Preservation at the Planning Commission, and some staff over here. This is Marcus Lotson, Director of Development Services, if you don't know him. And this is Julie. This is Julie Yon. She's IT. Sally Helm is administrative out there. This is Jamie Zerillo. He is a preservation planner, and Caitlin Chamberlain is a senior preservation planner. Did I miss anybody? Oh, we have Bridget back there. Bridget Lee is back there, and Kendra Tashome is back there as well. And they're going to speak to you a little bit too, but mostly this is about you all today. So I'm gonna let you go ahead and start. Introducing yourself. Yep. Yep.
Hi, my name's Leslie Anton. I'm with the Beehive Foundation.
And I'm David McDonald, President of the Downtown Neighborhood Association.
Michael Owen, CEO, Tourism Leadership Council.
Rob Becker, member of the DNA.
Ellen Harris, representing DNA.
Ryan Jarls, Director of Preservation and Historic Properties for Historic Savannah Foundation.
Sue Adler, CEO, Historic Savannah Foundation.
Thank you. And if anybody else comes in, I'll have them introduce themselves too. But I was going to talk about the meeting structure for a minute, and then the impetus for your all stakeholder meeting. So how this meeting is going to be structured is that you all will discuss the items on the agenda in an open discussion amongst yourselves, like you would do at a normal roundtable meeting. You can, but you don't have to review each item on that agenda, on this agenda one by one, because they're really all interrelated, and you'll probably just end up talking about them just all at once. The main goal is that you do discuss each one and provide your input on each one. That's the goal. So you don't have to go down the list. We'll just sort of double-check at the end to make sure that each one was covered. So after approximately 45 minutes or so, or when you all have decided that you've exhausted your discussion, staff is going to open the floor to public comment. We're going to do it in, again, a little bit unusual manner, and we're going to sort of close your all's discussion and then open a public comment period at the end. So a member of the public will be permitted to speak if they filled out a blue speaker card and if they signed in the sheet outside the door. Sally, who I introduced, she can give you a blue speaker card if you don't have one. She's right there. So if you haven't done that or signed in yet, she can help with that. If you're not certain that you want to speak, fill out one anyway, and you can decline at that time. And so that's blue speaker card is obviously for the people in the room. I'm sorry, I didn't see you over there, Melissa. Melissa Pauletto, it works in Marcus's Department of Development Services, is all over there. So if you are online, you will use the raise your hand feature that you can find on your control panel. There'll likely be folks on there. The National Park Service, I believe, this is how we ended up doing this, is because they wanted to come in virtually. So we're recording it and doing this virtually. So you use the raise your hand feature located on your control panel, and then when it's your turn, when your name's called, it you'll be unmuted when it's your turn to speak. Again, if you're not certain you want to speak, still provide a card or use the raise your hand feature, and you'll have the option to decline when your name is called. And in the essence of time, and try not to repeat points made by another member of the public, if at all possible. I will repeat this information later, but I wanted to sort of get the structure of the meeting out there at the beginning so everybody understands sort of how it's going to go. All right. All right, so the MPC has asked you all to come together again. If you recall, you all were the stakeholder group all throughout the new zoning ordinance process. And at least once, if not twice, I believe, since the new zoning ordinance was adopted, to make a couple more tweaks to it since then. So there was a new project was proposed to the HDBR. Part one COA was approved in December of 2020 for a residential building, which is a single family with a ground floor ADU. That's the rendering of the building on the left. That's the parcel on Pulaski Square in the center. And on the right is an image of what's there currently, which is, I believe it's three or four apartments in a accessory dwelling. Three or four accessory dwelling units at the rear of the property. So this was approved, part one height and mass was approved in December 2020. When the project came back for part two design details at the September meeting and months leading up to that meeting when the sign went up, many members of the public were concerned about the project. The reasons, there were a lot of reasons, so I don't want anybody to think I'm intentionally eliminating any of the reasons that came up, but the major items that we're going to discuss on your agenda today are such as the subdivision of tithing lots and principal buildings adjacent to lanes or facing north-south streets. 336 Marnard was subdivided. You can see the red outline. That portion was subdivided from the front, which, as you can see, is also subdivided into condos, not physically subdivided as it's shown there, but it is multiple condos, and that's why it looks like it's subdivided there. So it was subdivided from the main building in 2019, and the non-contributing lane buildings were approved to be demolished, and this new building on the left constructed. Comments were that tithing lots should not be subdivided, should never be subdivided, that it's inconsistent with the Oglethorpe plan, that there should not be buildings taller than two stories on a lane, even when facing a north-south street. Buildings on tithing blocks should not face north or south, only east or west. After the HDBR chair, who she just walked in, so I'm gonna let her say her name for the record.
Ellie Isaacs.
She's the chairman of the Historic District Board of Review, chairwoman. After the HDBR chair heard these concerns at the September HDBR meeting, she wrote a letter to the MPC requesting that the agency, that our agency begin the review process, in quotes, to revise the subdivision regulations to potentially include allowing the HDBR to review proposed subdivisions prior to approval. She further requested that the stakeholder group be assembled to consult on the language for potential text amendments. So staff reached out to the stakeholders to schedule this meeting and began researching the current and past conditions of the Oglethorpe plan as it relates to subdivision of tithing lots and north-south facing buildings in the same type of tithing lot location. And we're going to provide some of those results so that you have a little bit of context before you start your discussion. So there are 130 buildings on tithing blocks that face a north-south street currently. That map is the second from the left over there, if anybody wants to look at it physically, once I flip away from it. 17 of which are non-historic, the rest are considered historic or contributing, so 17 of 130 of them. The contributing building map is the furthest on the right. 95 of which are subdivided tithing lots, that map is not up there. I'll show it to you on here. So here's the contributing building map that's furthest to the right. And then this one is what we call at the bottom partial lot width, lot widths facing north-south service streets. So 95 of the 130 are on subdivided tithing lots. Number four, the oldest of which, the oldest of which we found is constructed in 1790. The newest was built, was subdivided in 2011. And here's one that's gone now. This is our, was our second oldest, 1853. Our newest was built, was subdivided in 2012 and built in 2014. So we have not had a subdivision like this in a decade. And the last one is, per the current, and I did this map by hand, per the existing subdivision regulations, which are here, which other than single family detached and attached, there's really no minimum or no maximum lot sizes. There are some lot coverage regulations and some lot width regulations, but generally there's no lot area per unit regulations. That was a change couple years before NUZO as well, to increase as requested to increase density.
What is the coverage?
I'm sorry, it's right here on this. So depending on the zoning district, lot coverage is different. These are increasingly commercial, from DR to DX, increasingly commercial. All of our, as you all know, every single one of our zoning regulation or zoning districts are mixed use. We don't have any purely commercial or purely residential districts. So I did this map by hand because it's not quite as cut and dry as the other ones. Tithing lots that could qualify for subdivision under the current subdivision regulations, it's not quite cut and dry as the other maps, because in practice, it's very difficult to knock down a historic building. So if there were a historic building covering a full parcel, for example, we didn't highlight that one. For example, we did highlight them at the bottom. You can see we highlighted if there was a historic carriage house that had a courtyard, because in theory, in practice, under the current regulations, you could separate that carriage house from that historic main house. So you will see that some parcels we highlighted are historic parcels. So it's a little bit more fluid than the other maps, which is why I did it by hand. So, but I think it does get the point across about the expanse of where this could happen on tithing blocks. And the black that I blacked out is, those are the trust blocks. So we're not talking about trust blocks today, it's talking about tithing blocks. Okay, so with that being said, the city departments, so Bridget and Kendra are gonna talk a little bit about a couple of the other things that you're gonna see on your agenda today. And that has more to do with ADUs and in light of some of the work that they've been doing.
Yep, sorry, they're coming.
Good afternoon. How's everybody doing? My name is Bridget Liddy. I'm Director of Planning and Urban Design with the City of Savannah, and I have Kendra Tashome with me, who's our senior planner. On your agenda, there are a couple items related to accessory dwelling units as well as accessory structures, specifically looking at the height of these buildings as they are adjacent to the lanes, as well as their footprint. But prior to us getting into the dialogue, I wanted to turn it over to Kendra to talk a little bit about a survey that we recently completed, and she can give you a brief update on that study.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. So the city did distribute a survey on accessory dwelling units to the public. We've received roughly 680 or so responses back from a diversity of neighborhoods across the city. There's pretty strong positive public sentiment for opening the ordinance up and allowing accessory dwelling units in other locations throughout the city. As I'm sure you're aware, there is the 200% lot minimum requirement that kind of closes up the opportunity for parcels in residentially zoned districts. So there was really strong sentiment for that. There was some great response with regard to the height of accessory dwelling units in historic districts. And then there was also some interesting responses about parking requirements. People really weren't interested in seeing parking spaces for new ADUs. And then outside of that, I think that one of the, I can't really remember what else I wanted to touch on there. Okay, so there was good sentiment, there was some bad sentiment for parking, and there was strong sentiment for managing the height of ADUs in the historic district.
Yeah, and I think based on our survey, we're not going to be changing anything in the current ordinance related to the height of accessory dwelling units if they are in the historic district. So the good news is a lot of the historic overlays already have the language in there that precludes people from going higher than two stories. That's it.
Thank you. So I'm going to open it up to you all to discuss the items on the agenda. I can stand here to, if you want to say, hey, show me the map that is for the tide blocks, I'll be standing here to do that. But otherwise, I'll be taking notes and it's all yours.
So, Lee, a couple of us, I know DNA and Beehive have opening statement, if you want to call it that, and what our positions are on those. If you want to start with that, and we can use those as talking points for the group, perhaps. Okay. You want to go first, Leslie?
Okay. Hi again. I'm Leslie Anton, and Gary Arthur, the president of the Beehive Foundation, is away today, but has asked me as operations manager to deliver this statement on his behalf. The brilliant town plan that the founder of the colony bequeathed to Savannah in 1733 continued apace in its basic configuration as the town grew more than 100 years after General Oglethorpe left the fledgling colony, never to return. That design, with small park-like squares encircled by trust lots and tithing blocks, was followed and repeated over and over all those years. We have lost a lot, yes, and there have been dozens and dozens of departures and aberrations from that original vision, some of which have compromised the human scale of our city. But such departures and aberrations should never be the justification for allowing this same mistakes. The integrity of the standards of the Oglethorpe Town Plan is once again at a crisis point, with entities minimizing or flouting the importance of those principles. The lanes and scale and orientation of structures on them are an intrinsic part of the plan. We at Beehive Foundation urge you to take to heart our entreaties and the recommendations of our fellow advocates here and correct the short-sighted path of dumbing down what makes Savannah unique. Thank you.
Ellen Harris will speak for Downtown Neighborhood Association.
So interested residents of the Downtown Neighborhood Association met in September to discuss this meeting in particular. The group felt an overriding obligation of any ordinance that's applicable to the Savannah Historic District should protect the character-defining features, which are the building blocks of the Oglethorpe Plan, retain the National Historic Landmark status, and specifically the main building courtyard carriage house configuration. And the group developed a consensus on some guiding principles that we felt like were important for this discussion as we move forward. One, that the process for reviewing subdivisions as well as aggregations within the landmark district should include a public process as well as public notice. In order to foster additional community engagement and transparency, the committee felt like COA applications could be posted up to the HDBR agenda as soon as reasonable after receipt of a deadline, recognizing that, of course, staff reports would not come out later, so this would be only what the applicant submitted. That the subdivision on tithing lots on an east-west access within the Oglethorpe Plan area should not be permitted. That within the DN and DR districts, essentially the residential areas, as well as Warren Ward properties abutting these districts, no building should be taller than 25 feet within 20 feet of a lane. Within these the residential districts, consideration should be given to the amount of footprint along the lane. It may be that reducing the overall lot coverage might be warranted, or requiring a minimum setback from the main building to the carriage house, perhaps a maximum building depth, or potentially a maximum footprint size. Within the residential districts, main entrances should not be permitted on north-south streets when abutting a lane. And consideration should be given to buildings and parcels which have already been subdivided. And instead of having these parcels be grandfathered in, they should be required to come into compliance when redeveloped in the future. We feel that the embracing these principles is necessary to prevent unintended and incremental changes from the Oglethorpe plan that jeopardize the National Historic Landmark status. As the National Park Service stated in their letter of September 26, that these changes are representatives of the sort of incremental change that collectively can result in the ill effects to the integrity of the NHL districts. And that was in reference to the 336 Barnard Street that Ms. Mihalik introduced the meeting. We don't feel that we can afford to degrade the integrity of the NHL, and we are asking the city to take the lead in the preparation of a cultural landscape report that is recommended by the National Park Service, paired with a detailed analysis and recommendations regarding current ordinances, procedures, and processes as they relate to the protection or degradation of the NHL district. Thank you.
I was prompted to speak. I represent the tourism industry, and all that sounds very reasonable to me, every bit of it. So who's in opposition of those points? And I think we should hear from them.
We've actually been in talks with Ms. Harris with the Downtown Neighborhood Association, and we are in full support of that survey that she spoke of.
It can't be that this is non-controversial.
Yeah. Sue, any comments from HSF?
I do want to add one just quick, not really a comment, but more so, I feel like this is a good educational opportunity for us all. All of us speak about the Oglethorpe plan as if we're experts on it, but I wouldn't say that any one person in this room is the expert. So I feel like there should be an educational opportunity or a gathering of the minds, I'll say it. HSF is willing to host, and we're hoping to do so in mid-November, date to be determined. But we would like to bring together experts such as Thomas Wilson, who wrote the actual book, The Oglethorpe Plan. People like Dr. Goebel have agreed to be part of this group. And more so, not necessarily biased one way or the other, but just a place to gather information on the Oglethorpe plan, learn what it is, learn all the aspects of it prior to actually making any decisions moving forward, if we're making those decisions based on the Oglethorpe plan. So that date will be coming out at some point, but we do have a sign-up sheet that we'll put out. If you would like to add your name and email to that sign-up sheet, just that we make sure that anyone who would like to be invited to this meeting can do so. And it will be a virtual option, because Thomas Wilson does not live in Savannah anymore. So we would like to make sure that anyone who cannot attend in person can do so virtually as well.
One of the things that I wanted to question, I guess, is for further elaboration is number 7 that's on your list of how you propose to do that for properties that are already listed as historic, that are over 50 years of age, that are listed as contributing properties within the district.
So it would only apply when they would, if they were to be redeveloped. So for example, okay. if the likelihood of a contributing property, you know, burning or something is relatively small, but it is possible that a building that currently has a contributing property could be redeveloped in the future, but that would only apply to that one.
I see the last word there. I missed the last word. Thanks.
A quick question. Is there documentation from the National Park Service on what the requirement is for us to be able to adhere to the landmark district status?
In their 2018 report, they made some very general recommendations on things that they identified as threats, but they left it up to the community to come up with a specific implementation plan for that. So they did not provide very specific instructions, but rather left that up to the community.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Substantial to that recommendation was what was happening with the Civic Center development, the old Civic Center development, correct?
They identified a number of ones, and that was certainly a big one, yes.
I'm just going to interrupt you for one second. I totally forgot to mention this because we're going to take write minutes. So even if you just say your name real quick before you start talking. Sorry about that. Thank you.
And I would like to add also to, I'm Sue Adler with Historic Savannah Foundation. I would like to add also that I've recently had a conversation with the National Park Service, and we have to really look to them as a resource. They're not going to tell us what to do. The community needs to come together to make some of these decisions. Again, I agree with what Ryan said. Ellen has made some wonderful suggestions today. So I think we have to look together, but not expect that the National Park Service is going to come down and tell us what to do. They are there as a resource for our community.
We need to look at this agenda and have a discussion on each one of these items, and you get a general sense of where everybody is on them.
Sure. If you all think that is the best way, we can absolutely do that.
So the interrupt certainly is David for the minutes there. Bridget, I think you heard, I know I didn't send you a soft copy of this, and I can correct that this afternoon, but would the city be amenable to looking at what Ellen's recommended as far as, and Leah will give you a copy of it, the hard copy there, as far as looking at this cultural study that the NPS recommended and the suggestion that I guess the consensus is up here that we go forward with looking at this as a master plan or some sort.
Yes, Bridget, just for the record, I think we would be more than willing to entertain this and look at it. I know we're currently in our budget deliberation process, so it might be something that we could look at supporting and also partnering with you all to maybe look at doing something like this. Definitely.
I know the DNA is interested in being a partner, and there may also be grants available, just to put that out there. So to Michael's suggestion about Michael's suggestion about going through one by one, I'll just throw out something for the subdivision and recombination of tithing and trust lots. I think DNA's position is, the most importantly is that there be some sort of public notice and a public process for comment on, on the subdivision as well as recombination of tithing lots and trust lots as well.
Michael, for the record, unless you disagree, and then I'm Joe Marinelli. It's fine with me. So what's the current, is there a current notice, and what does that look like right now? Is that a change or?
I'll let Marcus, I'll probably botch it, so I'll let him tell you.
Hi, so right now the process for subdivision regulations in the city is an administrative process. It does not include a public hearing, and that includes properties in downtown or anywhere within the city. Every property has minimum standards for size, and if those properties can meet that standard without a variance, then they can be subdivided. If there's a variance requested or required, then there would be a public hearing for that. That would be heard by the Zoning Board of Appeals, which would go through their normal public process in terms of notice, which would be to adjacent property owners and signage, et cetera. But absent any variances, if the property can meet the minimums, then it would be done administratively. Yes, sir.
I have a question. This is Leah. Could you just, so is there a way to say no if they meet all of those? Like if it goes through a public notice? I mean, you can't really, I'm legitimately asking, can you say no if it's meeting all of those?
Well, the way the rules are currently written, if they meet the standards, then it's an approved division of the property. There can be reasons to say no to a subdivision, But there aren't reasons if they meet the standards, if that clarifies that. So right now, there is no subjectivity in the subdivision regulations. It's minimum size, it's minimum width, it's access, it's those kind of things that have to be identified on a plat. If they meet those standards, then it is approved and recorded and those new lots are created.
This is Ellie. So there's no review of each property as it relates to like the Oglethorpe plan or visual compatibility or anything like that, because you're just doing the subdivision?
No, there is not. You're correct. Right.
Mm. Ms. Rob Becker, could you in the overlay district have special criteria for subdivisions within the historic district?
I think the short answer is yes. I think it would also depend on the nature of those criteria. When you're talking about the subdivision of properties, historically, what has mattered is, do they meet the minimum requirements? I think to a certain extent, property owners need to have some understanding that the property can or either cannot be divided, and what is that going to be based on? Because many times that refers back to a purchasing decision that somebody might make. If they're going to purchase a property with the knowledge that they can subdivide it, then that might be a major factor in why they purchase that property, even though they may not be subdividing it to a future date. I think to answer your question, yes, there can be criteria. But I think when you get into subjectivity as it relates to subdivisions, then you're probably in a gray area legally.
But provided it could be clear, it could be done in the overlay district.
Yes.
One of my first ideas when I first submitted the letter was that it come before HDBR. So it would become in front of each HPC or HDBR, depending on the district.
Is there any reason not to do that? From a staff perspective, a work volume perspective, a legal rights perspective, is there anything you're aware of that would indicate that was not a great idea, in your opinion?
And when you are you referring to bringing a subdivision to, say, the HDBR?
You're essentially putting subjectivity into it by that process to a certain extent, depending on how you construct it. But is there a reason to not have each subdivision come before a body?
I think it would be a matter of what the criteria is for review. If there are established criteria that are appropriate, then certainly a board like the HDBR could make that decision. But I think the potential entrance of subjectivity is an issue when you'll have properties that are, say, outside the landmark district that would may be very similar in nature, just dimensionally, that you are going to subdivide, and others that you will not.
What?
My comment was that, but those properties would then be outside of the district, right? And then you would just put it into the overlay. And if you base the criteria in the original forethought of the Oglethorpe plan, then there's your criteria, in theory. Just throwing this out there.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm the ignorant person in the room, so everyone please be patient with me. Again, I'm Joe Marinelli with the Physicist Valley. Or Trip Tollison was seated, whichever you want. Ellen, help me understand here, because I really do view you as subject matter expert on this. So I beg your pardon? So you the thought is, and it seems, I mean, on its face of it, it seems very reasonable to me that you want to put this before HRB or a body of approval. So what exactly would you be approving at this point? What's not lost on me is Mark is saying, look, this is administrative. It's rather digital. You either are or are not this thing. It seems to me that that would be very plain on its face on whether or not it's a yes or no, meaning it shouldn't go before a deciding body unless you're putting something in that's going to be less clear of a yes or no. So what is that thing that you would put in that would actuate the ability to say yes or no? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And Marcus, correct me, sorry, this is Ellen. Correct me if I'm wrong. There are some provisions in the subdivision ordinance that talk about the historic features of the site. There's one that does allow for some flexibility. And if I'm not mistaken, that criteria has been used to not allow for the subdivision of interior lots along the lane in the past. So there is one standard that's already in place that does allow for some flexibility. I think you would want it to be clearer for folks, especially when you're going before a board, as Marcus was saying. And I think as Ms. Isaacs noted, if we put the criteria together written in such a way that it talks about the original Oglethorpe form and plan, and for example, it could be that you could specifically say in D, and I'm not suggesting this hard and fast, but in the DN and the DR districts, no tithing lot shall be subdivided on an east-west axis. And that's one of the standards. So someone could look that up, see if they met that criteria. If they still meet it and want to move forward, yes. If not, they would not, you know, they would know in advance to provide some level of certainty as they move forward in the process. And of course, MPC staff is also always there to answer questions, as you know, as development moves forward.
And I think that's the type of criteria, you know, not necessarily that specific language, but the type of criteria that you could add to requirements for properties within any certain district and say, if you're in this district based on the historic pattern, you have to meet this standard. And if you can't meet this standard, then the property can't be divided. I don't see that there's any issue with that. I think that would require a much larger public process to get to that point, because that would impact every property owner that, you know, has property within the district. So I think we would need substantial feedback on that issue, because it's a zoning matter essentially that would have to be adopted as a change by the mayor and aldermen. So it would probably require a larger public process to get to those kind of criteria and what they would be, because it does have a wide-reaching impact.
I just have a follow-up question, just ballpark, not holding you to it. Again, this is Ellen. About how many subdivisions do you see, either trust lots or tithing lots or any lots within the Landmark District? I know Leah had noted one from 2014 of a similar one to 336 Barnard, but is that the only ones since 2014, or have there been others that aren't?
Many subdivisions within the district, but not as many specific to tithing lots. And I think you had some, did you have some numbers on that? You want to go back to that?
There was the one that I mentioned was the least one of that, of this condition that we're discussing has not happened in 10 years.
But I guess my question is, have others happened that aren't? Okay.
Before that?
No, just within the last 10 years.
Oh, I only looked at that condition.
Thank you.
Of tithing lots.
Numbers, there were six that were done in the last 2 years.
So for the record, that was six subdivisions in that circumstance over the last 2 years.
So, Michael, if I understood your question correctly, it's the benefit of the change. I think one of the benefits is public input. Currently, staff does this behind the scenes, and no one knows what's going on. You don't know that your neighbor has subdivided and is going to build some kind of house behind their current house. So just having that public knowledge that we're aware of what's going on in our community, to me, would be advantageous.
Yes, but I don't disagree with that at all. But if there isn't a provision that's going to be put into place to stop it, right? In other words, again, back to sort of this thing, then it makes more sense to require notice, so on and so forth. But if it is out of the hands of it's like a lot of alcohol permits, if you'll go with me on this, because you know I've done a lot of work on this, right? For the most part, an alcohol permit is in fact a right when you've met certain requirements. If you're this far away from a school, you're this far away from a church, you don't have crimes of moral turpitude, and so then anybody can define that, right? But for the most part, if you meet those requirements, that license is absolutely yours to get. And if a city withholds it, for a reason that's not specified in the ordinance, they open themselves up to a lawsuit. We've actually endured that in this community.
Is this a, and this is my ignorance, and it's a genuine question, is this sort of a similar thing? I mean, what you're telling me is, look, it's administrative. If you do this, this, and this, it's yours. Well, then a public hearing doesn't make any sense, because there's no amount of public pressure that could change the fact that they've met the requirements. If it's transparency you're after, which I think should be more in almost all cases of everything we deal with in this community, then that's more of a public notice. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I'm not against a public hearing, but you've got to add something into it that empowers whoever that body is to lawfully stop it or withhold something, which I understand now currently they get by right if they qualify. Mm-hmm.
And let me just say, make this point, is that I think there's two things that we're talking about here today. And one is additional criteria to be able to subdivide property within the district, and then having a public hearing process to make that known to the public. I think those things potentially could be separated with the same goal achieved. If the proper criteria is brought forth, then an applicant will still have to meet that criteria, but they'd still have the right to subdivide their property should they meet it. So I think we can talk about, you know, what the criteria should be at some point. And if we can establish that, whether there be a public hearing or not, I think is moot. I think the point is to only, it seems to be the position of many here today, at least, to only be able to divide property under certain circumstances. So we just need to establish what those circumstances are.
Marcus, this is Rob Becker. If we were to create that criteria, does the ordinance allow for variances?
Well, there are many things that are variable within the ordinances. Some things are specifically not variable, so that language could also be created at the time of any amendment to the ordinance.
I was just trying to answer Joe's question. I think that if not written very specifically, and you open up the door to variances, you would need then to have public comment to comment.
Well, and keep in mind that all variance processes are public hearings as well, so that would be a public process regardless. The COA process would be a public process. So there'll be many opportunities to comment on a potential project should it go either through a variance process or in a historic district, new construction, even without one. So I think to further the point you were making is that, yes, I think it's always important when you're adding language to be very specific about what you can and can't do with the processes, so that if the desire is for something to not be variable, you can actually say that within the ordinance. There are things that are not variable, there are things that are, and we can enumerate that.
To answer Michael's analogy, within 1 mile of where we're standing or sitting, there are 300 ABC licensed establishments. So you can't get too many.
I mean, here we go, but the law is the law. So, and I don't have a problem changing. And again, even in this process, I don't have a problem changing it so long as it's predictable, right? So long as it's clear what must be done or what may not be done in order to attain a certain sort of outcome. And that's not just my opinion. It's the charter and OCGA. We agree. Can someone put that in the paper, please?
I took that note.
This is Ryan Jarls. Marcus, do you mind if I backtrack just a moment?
Go for it.
Earlier, Leah said that there was one subdivision of this type within the downtown district since 2014. Then Bridget Liddy stated that there had been six total. Was that of that condition or six subdivisions total?
Oh, no, that was specific to the
mine was specific to this condition. Okay. Bridget's was total in the downtown district.
Okay.
Six in the last how long?
I just wanted confirmation that it was six total, not six in that condition. Thank you.
This is Ellen. I just want to say that while we can come up with some pretty, you know, specific criteria, and maybe then a public hearing does not need to be required, and we don't have that criteria yet, so we can't say for sure yet. I guess I just worry that criteria can be very specific and very clear cut in 95% of cases, and it's those 5% of cases that, you know, one could argue, it's because we've all, you know, been in this room and see how the attorneys can argue that the criteria doesn't apply because of X, Y, and Z, and then you leave it up to a board to decide if that's true and correct. And I would say, and it's also important to allow public comment on it. Even if it is cut and dry, there's nothing they can do. I still think I'm still a proponent of allowing for public comment on it. Thank you.
Yeah, Ellen, you want to go down to the next one if we're done with that issue? Did you want to? Yeah, good.
Thank you.
Just keep going down the bullets.
Okay, I'll throw this one out there. The next on the agenda is the development of corner lots. I'm going to just assume that means corner lots on the corner of a lane and a street. If we want to just talk about that specifically, not on corner lots in general. I don't know, that this kind of ties into the whole discussion more than one specific topic. You know, DNA would say we don't think that in that specific condition that it should be allowed an east-west subdivision, that within the residential districts that the form on the lane should remain a carriage house and allow for the main house, courtyard, carriage house configuration, recognizing that that is different in the commercial districts, such as Broughton Street, et cetera, where you do see more intensive development. Basically, in any area where 75% lot coverage, we feel like that form should be maintained on street lane intersections.
This is Ryan. Ellen, how would we word that then, if we are to move forward with this criteria, do we separate it out into, you know, there's certain criteria for the commercial portion of downtown and there's certain criteria for, you know, residential areas around different squares? Like if we were doing this, if someone on Jones Street decided to get rid of that beautiful bank building at the corner of Broughton and what street is that? Broughton and Abercorn. I'm just going to throw out a street. The SunTrust building. If that were to be torn down, would there be a separate criteria for this commercial area to allow for something just almost as big to be constructed back because it is in this commercial district, or would it be required to fit the same criteria as the other? And how would we go about doing that?
This is Ellen. Just so not trying to write the standards, but first blush, we have examples in the current ordinance and the current zoning ordinance of saying in the DN and the DR districts, which are two residential districts which have 75% lot coverage, then these standards apply. In all other zoning districts, these are the standards to apply. So we have that as an example that we could use that same format to have separate criteria, because I do think it's important that there are separate criteria for those areas. They have different development patterns.
This is Rob Becker. Adding to that, I think another comment that we had was that anything within 20 feet of a lane would be limited to two stories or 25 feet. I think that was another important criteria. And then the other word, I appreciate everyone doesn't have some of the notes that we had written, but we'd used the word any building that was within 25 feet of a lane be, or 20 feet of a lane be limited to 25 feet. It was very important because a lot of the references now in the ordinance require, I think, talk about ADUs. And we don't want to have anyone claim something isn't an ADU to exempt themselves from that limit. And so we think that the structure itself, if it's within 20 feet, should be limited to a 25 feet, despite what you call it.
The use, mm-hmm. The actual use would be.
And this is Ellen. I'll add one more thing onto that, just about the specifics of the language. We specifically noted 25 feet in height as the maximum, and we did not say two stories, even though in other places in the ordinance it does refer to height as measured in stories. In this particular case, we think it's important that it be measured in feet because of things like elevator overruns or things like that that can be allowed to be, that's not considered a story, that can be allowed higher. We think 25 feet means 25 feet along the line.
Including overruns and such.
Parapet heights, et cetera.
What I was pulling up was that portion in the the ordinance, I think it's a large scale development standard possibly, but about, there is a portion that's within 20 feet of a lane. You can't be more than two stories tall, I believe it is, but I believe it's a large scale development standard. And it's only when you're across from a certain zoning district too, I believe. So, but that could be a place to potentially expand, I guess. I'll pull that up so you know what I'm talking about. So large scale development is subject to this standard right here, two stories maximum within 25 feet of a lane. If you're large scale development. So that could be repeated. That says two stories, like you said, maybe 25 feet instead or something like that, but. Heights of stories are defined by the ordinance.
As what?
I will show you where they're defined separately by commercial and by residential. I'll show you where they are. Right here, under height.
So this is Ellen. I think. Yeah, so I think this is a good point that the ordinance defines it as minimums and not necessarily as maximums, and so that's another reason why we feel there should be a 25 foot maximum cap.
This is Ryan. I just have another question, looking for some clarification. So if there was a case where there's historic precedent for, let's say, a lot such as what HSF owns, we just recently constructed an addition to the rear of the Kennedy Pharmacy building, which has a corner door facing a north-south street. If there was a historic precedent through maybe Sandborn Map research or other research that there was a corner store, and I'm speaking specifically on corner stores, present in a certain location, how would this affect the ability to bring that historic item back or that historic precedent for a corner store configuration back into play?
There could be a special exception. Yes. You could apply for a special exception.
Exactly what I was going to recommend.
I think this brings up an important, Ms. Robbecker, as we're creating these rules, I think we try to create the rules for the norm and not to try to address each of the exceptions, because as you create rules that address exceptions, you essentially diminish the intent of what your rule is. And so while I think that there's room for discussions, and those are those variances I think that we had mentioned earlier, we do need to be very specific about what the intent of this is and what the rules are, and in order to preserve what we want. Because people will bend the exceptions to become the norm.
Anything else on that one? I think kind of answers number three. It's all on the same lines there, obviously. So entrances on tithing lots on North South streets. I actually have a question about that one, because a lot of times historically carriage houses will have entrance on the North South street. If you could discuss that, just so I have an idea of, would that be not something then? Because we're talking about no entrances on North South streets then. So how would something like that be handled?
This is Ellen. Another, and maybe this is a one of those, you know, opportunities for additional research so we can get a better understanding about, you know, where that exists, how much it exists, is that, you know, the historic precedent for that. But, you know, my initial reaction is, you know, I think for new carriage houses on lanes, the main entrance, well, essentially the main entrance is going to face, historically would have likely faced the main house, but there would be an entrance facing the lane, and perhaps a secondary entrance facing the street might be a permissible scenario. But for the public perspective, the main entrance would be facing the lane, would be my initial thought for discussion.
Just food for thought of what I'm talking about here, right across from. 336 Barnard is this historic configuration. And it does not. Well, I don't know if it never did, but doesn't have an entrance on the lane at this time.
Actually, garbage can.
Yeah.
That's a different unit.
And one facing the port.
It's just food for thought for right now.
This is Ryan. I think what we're getting at there is that the primary entrance be facing the lane. There can be secondary entrances, but they have to be subordinate to.
Yeah, how do you?
I don't know how you would define that.
Well, I guess that's my, you know,
Right.
detail.
I think that maybe it would depend on use. That maybe you would define it depending on if the carriage house is intended for a commercial use versus a residential use.
Why?
What do you mean, why?
Why would it matter? I mean, if this is, again, truly, forgive my ignorance, we're going to be doing that a lot. If this is aesthetics, if this is, you know, the plan, then why would it matter what the use is? I mean, if you put another, looking at this particular example, if you put another set of windows above that door and ground level, and then add one more story on top of it, we're back to the Barnard Street issue right over again. And I don't understand the nuances of this. And so I'm trying to understand and would like to not be invited to further meetings like this. Maybe the worst one I've ever had, and I've been yelled at by people. What's the difference in if this is an aesthetic issue, then why would it matter if it was a hardware store versus an apartment for a student or a VRBO?
Because, okay, so prime example right there that Leah's looking at, you can tell the one on the left facing west is clearly residential, right? So there's no door facing, you know, the main street. But then if you look on the opposite side of the street where the window configuration is clearly storefront, which has probably been converted to residential now, but that's beside the point. It was originally commercial. So then there's doors facing. So maybe in certain instances, you allow there to be an entrance if it's a commercial use, as long as the scale and the height and everything else is still appropriate.
Was the other one commercial?
No. Doesn't look up here. It doesn't look like
this one down here you're asking about.
Oh, yeah. The other one. Yeah. I mean, it could have been. The window's large. That's like a not typical.
Why would it matter if aesthetics is what we're trying to deal with? I mean, either that's acceptable aesthetically or it isn't.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
That's true. Yeah, use could always change.
I'm sorry, y'all. We have to wait until public comment.
Oh, sorry.
You're not on mic. I'm sorry. It's y'all get the old people at the end, fortunately.
I'm intending to agree with Michael that you know, uses can change, so something could be designed, you know, as initially as a storefront, they get converted back into a residential. Are they allowed to keep the thing? I think, you know, again, that goes back to, you know, perhaps there's an opportunity for a variance if there's a, you know, an exceptional situation, but the rule should be the rule.
Would be. And I recognize that knife cuts both ways. I mean, it could be never or always permissible.
Right.
You know, I think the, you know, someone else has to make that decision collectively.
And I'll leave it up to you all if you want to put a public comment in the middle or not, because you all are like about a third through your agenda items. So.
Right.
Yeah, listen, my only worry to all of this is there seems to be a lot of agreement here, and it feels like a vacuum, yeah. And I'm not educated enough on the other side, and I would very much like to hear the other side of the argument.
And I agree. I'm not going to comments, but I think for most of these agenda items, we're all in agreement, and you know, if we get the city to work with the plan and go forward with that study as we talked about, then that'll satisfy every issue we have here. And everybody at the dais is in agreement with all that.
You want to do public comment?
Yeah.
Can we start with virtual public comment? Do we need Julie for that? Can anybody who wants to speak virtually, can you please use the raise your hand feature on your control panel? Okay, we'll go with people in the room. Okay, there's nobody raising their hand. Okay. All right, Anna Habersham Wright.
Just because the National Park Service cannot force Savannah to implement decisions, it can revoke the National Historic Landmark status, which is critical to the tourism industry and many other aspects of Savannah. I think we can get clear criteria from the National Park Service about what would and would not constitute loss of that status. And I think Historic Savannah has been pretty cavalier about that. And I think they need to be ruled in a bit with some clear criteria on that subject. The 300th anniversary of the Oglethorpe Plan is coming up in 10 years. We should respect it. We should value it. And we should not keep coming up with these ridiculous weaselly ways of getting around it, which is what 336 Barnard Street has been, a really ghastly experience of variations and only variations as a result of the public calling the MPC up on these issues. It's just been, it's the Wild West. And I'm going to leave it at that.
I'm going to clarify, there is not a single variance given for 336 Barnard. I do just want to make that clear. There's not been a single variance given.
A zoning determination.
Okay, that's not the MPC. I just want to make that clear. No, no, ma'am. There haven't been any special exceptions or variances given at all.
Of 2017.
That's
the variance requested, whether it ended up
approved
or not. There's
okay. I didn't want to get an argument, but there Thank haven't you. Been any granted at this project. Meredith Delaney.
There are items in the plan, the 32-foot width, there's a huge deck on the roof, which is forbidden by the ordinances. There are multiple issues within 336 Barnard Street that the MPC simply said they all passed and there was no problem. And there should have been variances asked for, and I'll just leave it at that.
Sabrina Nagel. Okay, we'll do our one person online after Ms. Nagel goes.
I'm really glad to get to speak after that because I am a neighbor of the 336 Barnard situation and a property owner. So on the block, I own two properties, one of which is a double lot. So as a person who's directly behind it or in front of it, whichever way you look at it, I'm just baffled at how this all went down. I have a few things to say, but in response to the variance situation that they were just talking about, I had a thing to show, but they told me that I couldn't show it in this meeting. There was a variance requested, and a notice to property owners was emitted in September of 2017, and that is where all of this began. We were all told it was going to be a carriage house. There's the paper right here. I saved that notice from 2017. I have the actual notice that was mailed to me. I don't know how I saved it, but I did. So we were all told it was going to be a carriage house. There's a notice to adjacent property owners. That was all great, except it hindered. It actually was, it did more bad than good, because as we were all told that this was going to be a carriage house, we all thought, oh, okay, great. That's a good idea. So it's going to fall under the standards of a carriage house. It's going to be two stories. You know, we're all just people. We don't know all the codes like all of you do, and all the rules and all the standards, or at least we didn't before all this went down. And all of a sudden, it all changed. It all completely changed. It went from being a two-story, a petition for a variance for a two-story carriage house in black and white to all of us, to a mansion on a lane that doesn't fit any of the standards that this proposed carriage house was held to. So I actually have the proposition for the carriage house that was filed in September of 2017. And MPC did their job, or Historic Board of Review did their job. The staff reviewer did her job. It was slaughtered, and they were told to lower the roof line, and they were told to, it was too high at 31 feet. It was too high. The proposed mansion is over 45 feet. So why weren't those standards applied? Why were they held to those standards at the carriage house proposal, but not anymore at the mansion? I understand the lot was subdivided under our noses, and that really upset us, because I wasn't aware that a lot could be subdivided without any public input. So when you are a neighbor and you're sent a notice that's really great and you're allowed to speak, you're thinking that's going to come every time that they come up with a different change, right? They're going to notify us. That's what we all thought. It's a carriage house. That's great. We all want it. What you think is, if that changes, we're going to be notified. Turns out that didn't only change. The lot was subdivided with zero notice to us, and it became a four-story mansion without any notice to us. The next thing we know, we saw a sign on the side of the lot saying, for sale, mansion, live like a king on Pulaski Square. And we're like, what? When did it stop being a carriage house? So by the time we participate in these COA meetings, I feel we were not heard. I feel that the architect was praised, the builder was praised. I was in those meetings virtually. It was during COVID, and I felt almost shunned, like, oh, why would you ever go against such a beautiful thing being built? And I'm like, because I live there, because I have valid concerns over the height. I have valid concerns over garbage and sanitation. And, you know, all the people that praise the design, they don't live there. None of those people that spoke up there live there. I do, and many of us here do. And so by the time we woke up and realized it was no longer a carriage house, it was almost too late. So basically, I just want to point out two things, and I'll be brief. It seems like we're all in agreement, or at least almost all of us, with the exception of HSF, that we need to respect the Oglethorpe plan moving forward a little bit more, and we need to be a little bit more careful. I want to say on the proposition of the DNA, I find them all very, very good. I was at that meeting. But I do want to say, be careful with the notice to adjacent neighbors, because that's what we all got. And that's what got us here. We all let our guard down because that notice was sent to us. And then it turns out they changed everything and never told us. So I want to say that notice to adjacent neighbors, it just needs to keep coming. When you change stuff and you subdivide the lot and you make it into a mansion, let us know so we can come and participate. Don't just change it after you've told us it's going to be one thing and turn it into another. That wasn't fair to us. I want to say that the visual compatibility standards, like height and mass of surrounding buildings that currently exist, should apply as they did with the initial proposal of the carriage house. Why didn't any of those standards apply to this house? I understand having subdivided the lot allowed for anything goes. No more rules. They all flew out the window. But visual compatibility should still be a standard, whether the lot is a new lot or an old lot. It's still in the historic district. So where were the standards of the visual compatibility for this project? Nowhere. I didn't see a single staff review that talked about this project being too high, that talked about, for example, just to give out an example of the staff review on the proposed carriage house, which was extremely reasonable. The staff feels that the width of the building along Barnard Street should be reduced so that the overall proportion of the building is more in scale with the adjacent contributing structures. the same amount of space is left on both projects. The carriage house width along Barnard is the same. All of these topics are the same, and I had a really good little handout to give, and I'll give it to all of you when I'm done talking. Basically, they asked to reduce the overall height of the building. Again, that carriage house was proposed at 31 feet. The mansion that just passed with flying colors is over 45. Why weren't they held to the standards? In response to what HSF said earlier, as an educational opportunity, sir, that's really cool when you don't live right there. When you don't own two properties that are right there, when your properties in the downtown historic district are at pretty much jeopardy of value if we lose historic status, according to the National Park Service. So yeah, great educational opportunity. I agree with you, but those of us that live there are stuck with it. And it's awesome to learn, but it sucks to be stuck with it forever. And the other thing about using the National Park Service as a resource, yeah, it's already a resource. They're called standards. They're already there. They're written, they're in black and white. Why weren't those standards applied to this project? And that is all I have to say. I'm happy to give you my handout that I wanted to show, and I'll hand that out at the end of the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Sabrina. I will. Leah, maybe you can answer this question, because it is something that, and David, for the record, I've heard comments and complaints about this before. I'm not sure if the regulation is, as I recall it, that if a hearing is and public notice is given, the sign is posted on the site saying there's a hearing coming up. And if this happened at 336 in 2017, any subsequent hearing after that, they don't have to re-advertise.
Yes, they did. Absolutely.
But
they did.
All right, I don't see that. I don't see that in the building. So, all right, maybe not. Let's take 336 out of there. Let's go with other.
336 was reposted when the new project came back in 2020.
Right. Am I error in citing that as a reference? But I've seen this on other locations where they have subsequent hearings that we hear about after the fact that they're not re-advertising.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, that's if it's a current project that's continued.
Right.
So if a project is still active and it's continued to a subsequent month.
Can I just say one thing that will explain that, David? The reason is that
There's
a really good, I don't want to take anybody's more time, but there's a really good answer to that, and I'm glad you asked it.
This will explain it. All those requests were 123 West Charlton Street. So this used to belong to another address. When the address got changed because we came up with a new property and a new lot, then things got lost because it became a new property. So it depends how you look at it. Like, there was nothing else filed because it was called 336 Barnard. So it was no longer the original property. That's why.
All right, thank you. Right. That is something I think we should look at, though, Leah, is the notifications for continuances and things like that. I've heard comments and complaints from residents that they don't know about the other additional hearings.
Okay.
Michael Brown.
I'd like to have another approach to this. I'm strongly opposed to subdividing these lots, obviously, for aesthetic reasons. But I'd like you to take a look at it as an economic issue. I had pieces that were owned pieces of property and lived in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. for 25 years. And the reason that the value in Georgetown was the highest of any other value in the whole city of Washington was because of the restrictions. So the restrictions, and the quote was, restrictions equal value. And I know that sounds contrary, but it's not, it's true. Restrictions equal value. I think that one of the things that we never considered is this is a different PIN number now. Therefore, it's subject to the short-term vacation rentals. And everybody knows that a short-term vacation rentals requires a commercial license, and it requires to pay income tax or pay tax on your income, and it requires a tax ID number. So therefore, it's a commercial piece of property. So if a short-term vacation rental becomes made into one of these subdivisions, it's really a commercial piece of property. It's got a commercial license. It has to be applied every year as a commercial license. It's a commercial piece of property that generates income. And I think that that would be made aware, either that if it's not, if at least made as an exception where that can't happen. One of the things that, kind of struck me as strange is that during the survey, the 680 people surveyed were overwhelmingly in favor of subdividing, but how many of the 680 were in a landmark or historic district? And how can anybody in a landmark or historic district not say cavalierly that nobody's required, nobody's worried about parking? I mean, you make an additional, you make an additional lot and you have a short-term vacation rental, you got problems now. Can you imagine if you add 15, 20, 30 lots to a building? I mean, to a historic area? I mean, it would be overwhelming. And a good quick requirement, and this is a good example of, ignoring decisions made by the city. It's just, and this was, this goes back a few years, and I was involved with the Historic Savannah Foundation on it, is that there's a street, there was a street, that ran between Barnard, between Drayton and Abercorn. And it was where the mansions built. And that was a, it wasn't a lane, that was a street. It had a name. And the indication of the developer was, I'm not gonna, we're not gonna close that street because it's a street. So he assured everybody that it would be a, not be a street. Now, if you go by there, it's no longer a street. It's where he has his dumpsters, he has, it's closed off by a gate. And it, what it did, it prevented the development of the property on Abercorn, which is zoned commercial or zoned residential. So now that residential area, which is now his parking lot, which is illegal to zoning, it eliminated the opportunity for commercial residential properties to be built in a historic district. So I think it's really dangerous to just sort of cavalierly circumvent the rulings and requirements of the city and the landmark district. Thank you.
I will comment, Michael, that 336, the only way it can become a short-term vacation rental is if it's owner-occupied. There are, the caps are reached on all of the wards in the downtown area.
I'm sorry.
So it, if for, it, can, if it, can, it cannot be a legal short-term vacation rental unless the owner lives there. It has to be owner-occupied. The only short-term new short-term vacation rental licenses are owner-occupied in the downtown.
Mr. Brown.
Okay.
Yes. No, you can talk. You just got to talk.
So I know of short-term vacation rentals that aren't owner-occupied.
There is a cap per ward, only 20%.
Okay, that cap wouldn't exist anymore if you had more lots.
The cap is there per, it's per houses, or the ratio of the houses, 20%, I think.
That's the point. You're adding more houses.
Yeah.
So the cap increases.
But all the wards downtown are already over their caps and they're grandfathered in until they sell.
Correct. Okay, but let's assume that.
Agreed. That's a long term issue.
No, and I understand. I understand your argument. But if you're 47 foot house and you have four stories or four and a half stories, and you occupy one as a as your studio on the top, then you're owner occupying it. Thank you.
Correct. And they can happen. There's no limit on those.
Can you please unmute Anthony Maxwell online? Sorry for the wait, Mr. Maxwell. You're self-muted, Anthony, Mr. Maxwell.
Yeah.
All right, there you are.
Can you hear me now? Okay, yeah, I just wanted to tell you guys that I'm so glad that we are having these conversations about what's doable and what's not doable. I just wanted to just leave a comment. I'm hoping that the metropolitan planning community, particularly Black communities, the same voice, because I strongly feel, based on the feedback I've been getting from a lot of people, is that Black communities are not heard in Savannah when it comes to making sure that our communities are saved, just like other communities are saved and preserved. And that's really the best, that's the best job of the Metropolitan Planning Committee, to make sure that all communities are saved and preserved, not just certain ones. So I just hope that, you know, with that being said, that that comment, that they will just, you know, really take to heart that several communities are looking to the Metropolitan Planning Committee to be their voice. And that's all I have to say. Thank you so much.
Mr. Maxwell, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
All I can suggest, this is, I'm David McDonald, president of the Downtown Neighborhood Association. MPC listens to us because we listen to the residents downtown, and as one voice, we petition them, and we have people monitoring the agendas. And I would suggest that your community associations definitely do the same thing. Hold their feet to the fire.
I'm sorry.
I won't put them there.
Sir, I'm sorry. Say that again. I didn't hear you, sir.
I would get with your community organizations and make sure they petition the MPC whenever they see some kind of zoning ordinances there. Hold them accountable.
Okay. Definitely. Absolutely. But I do appreciate everyone being there, and I appreciate just the fact that everyone was allowed to speak their piece and their mind. And like I said before, I really, really would like to petition everyone listening today to be those individuals that stand up for all communities and not just certain communities, particularly the African-American community, who in Savannah has for hundreds of years have felt like they've not been heard. And we largely feel like that our communities are being ripped apart, just ripped apart with no concern, no value whatsoever. They're not coming. People are not coming to the communities and saying, hey, what would you like to do? You're the first stakeholder in this situation. They're just coming through our communities and taking what they want and saying, hey, this is what we're going to make money off of. This is what the city of Savannah needs. The city of Savannah needs communities that represent the whole entire city. And that's just not happening with African-American communities. It's not happening. They're coming in our communities and they're telling us what to do and what they're going to do. They're building things, they're doing things. And we need more situations like Harbor Village to happen, where communities like Brickyard and all these other places are slated as historical communities that have value. You know what I'm saying? So the people who did that with Carver Village, I applaud them greatly, because I grew up in Carver Village and I love that community. Okay. But have the resources been poured into that community like it's poured into other communities? No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Okay. Does it have value? It does.
Thank you, Mr. Maxwell. We're going to move on to the next person. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kathy Ledbina. Roger Helms.
My name is Robert Helms. I live at 244 East Oglethorpe Avenue at the corner of Lincoln and Oglethorpe. And I have a few comments. Generally, I agree with everything that's being said about the tithing lots and the subdivisions and why subdivisions. We lived for a long time in England in a grade two listed house and had to deal with the vagaries of the English planning system as it relates to historic houses. And the quick answer to most of what you're talking about is to make a lot of things subject to variance. In other words, that as a matter of norm, you have to get a variance for anything that is not really clear cut. And by really clear cut, I mean low height, appropriate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the things we've got now, but then you have you got to go to have a variance anyway for most everything. And you then have a board which will err on the side of permitting things, but has the ability, if the community gets excited, to step in and say, okay, we got to take a longer look at something like this. And the fact that you have to deal with that as a matter of right in the UK means that people don't buy a historic house if they think they're going to turn around and rip it down and build something new. because they start the planning process before they buy the house. And I think that that kind of approach would probably work better for the historic district than the current system of saying that a lot of stuff can be waived through by right. The other topic that I want to bring up is that we... the other thing... Do you want to turn that off?
Sorry.
Maybe you should walk out of the room. Anyway, the other thing that I want to bring up is that we have a situation on East Oglethorpe generally where East Oglethorpe is in the process of turning into West Oglethorpe. And by that, I mean that it is in the process of getting a lot of very tall, very massive buildings. The thing that's going up next to the police station is huge. The thing that is planned for 301 East Oglethorpe, which is currently a one-story, rather large footprint building, is also pretty damn big. So we have a risk that East Oglethorpe is going to wind up looking a lot like West Oglethorpe. And West Oglethorpe is not particularly attractive. You don't have a lot of carriage tours going around West Oglethorpe in the area between, you know, north of Liberty, between roughly Whitaker and Martin Luther King. That's just not an area that people think of as being particularly attractive for tourism. East Oglethorpe and the squares around it are likely to go the same way. If we start having a bunch of buildings as big as the Perry Lane around there, there's not going to be much left. And all those ghost tours that currently walk through the middle of the night through that area are going to find some other way of doing it. And we will lose historic National Historic District thing if all of Oglethorpe Avenue winds up looking like, all of East Oglethorpe winds up looking like West Oglethorpe. West Oglethorpe is not a particularly attractive area. And we are where we are, but we need to worry a little bit about the aesthetics of the entire plan. And the fact that East Oglethorpe is zoned the same as West Oglethorpe is part of the problem.
This is Rob Becker. Robert, I know you don't have a copy of all the notes that we had put in here, but one of the things that we did, we've been talking about subdivisions, but we also included aggregation of lots, which into the decisioning process, because I think that addresses some of the root.
Sperry, you got to speak on the microphone. Yeah, we're on a 3-minute time.
Okay. The issue with both 301 and the stuff next to the police department is that these are very, very big buildings, and they are completely out of scale with everything that's around them. And that sort of scale exists on West Oglethorpe, but the moment it exists on East Oglethorpe, there's no stopping.
I will say the police lot, DNA fought that. They wanted two more stories and is what's going to be built. We got the lane reestablished that they originally were going to build over. They wanted a bonus floor, which they eliminated. I mean, it would have been a lot worse than it's going to be.
Vance Fika, please.
Hi, my name is Vance Peacock. I live at 120 West Jones, and my carriage house shares Charlton Lane with the property in question at 336 Barnard. I'm also a ward captain for Pulaski Square with my husband, Darren. As a native of Savannah, I have a deep appreciation and respect for the laws in place that protect the integrity of the historic district. However, I am very concerned that these laws are being changed or nullified in favor of developers and special interest groups without proper oversight by boards or the public. In the case of 336 Barnard, the zoning department ignored a key zoning law, which further threatens our National Historic Landmark status. We desperately need to fix this broken system. I was really hoping that the National Park Service was going to be on the phone today, because I'd like for them to hear my direct plea for help. I'd like to call for the city manager to launch an immediate investigation into the irregular decisions made by the zoning department that led to today's meeting at 336 Barnard. We need people of integrity to protect our historic district, whether they be a bureaucrat or a board member. We need to take special interests, business connections, and personal connections out of the decisions that will impact our city's future for future generations. Yes.
I'm sorry if I mess up your last name, Darren Bryanton. I did it.
Thank you, folks. I'm going to actually speak on behalf of myself and my neighbor. I am also the co-ward captain of Pulaski Square and a property owner at both 120 West Jones and 121 West Charlton Lane, directly affected and adjacent to this property. I'm going to add to my husband's comments. I truly appreciate having the NPS involved here, present and concerned for National Historic Landmarks designation. I hope with their presence, we may finally be able to get some clarity into the city's oversight and enforcement of planning and urban development and design and the MPC, and shed some light on how this zoning determination ever happened in the first place, and also ensure it doesn't happen again. I'd also like to call on the city manager to launch an investigation into planning and urban design to see what this happened, why this happened. Speaking for my neighbor, Kyle Dwyer, who also owns two properties on West Jones Street, as a direct resident of the historic district and direct adjacent neighbor to the Barnard development, he'd like to say, I feel the process failed us. He had hoped that the standards would have applied to this project as with any other. He's a busy person and doesn't have time to police projects like this. He hopes the MPC and Historic Board of Review can do their job to prevent things like this from happening in the future. He is committed to living in Savannah with his wife and two kids, and hope the organization set in place will also do more to protect us. Thank you, folks.
James Hunsrucker.
Hunsrucker. Hello, my name is James Hunsrucker. I live in the Landmark Historic District for 32 years. I left the little town of Elmore to attend SCAD for a degree in historic preservation. I agree 100% that the city needs to investigate why this occurred, why this has gone under the radar for so long. Oglethorpe's plan has been debased by the subdivision of tithing lots. These bastardized examples are why new ordinances have been established to prevent further destruction, of Oglethorpe's plan. For some reason, the city has not upheld its obligations to protect that which they are stewards for, that which they are entrusted. I call for those failures to be cause of an independent investigation and termination of development and termination of employment to be the ultimate remedy for this and similar derelictions. The charm created by Oglethorpe's plan is the great hidden attraction that brings more people and money to Savannah than anything else. Protect Oglethorpe's plan with your lives, for it is the sacred fabric of Savannah. I would also like to point out what Mr. Brown addressed earlier about the development of Godwin Street. That's the street between Abercorn and Drayton that allowed the mansion to be what it is today. The mansion is under further development, and the Historic Savannah Foundation had a holding over the development of Godwin Street. They have passed further destruction of what that Godwin Street was supposed to hold sacred about the development in the historic landmark district. I also call for an ombudsman that can be possibly here to defend the public trust in and the lack of notification of the neighbors. That has been a strong issue in my neighborhood because we did not know. I live right by the mansion. Our neighbors did not know what was occurring with the mansion. Now, after the fact, we are faced with what we're faced with now. Anyway, that's my piece for now. Thank you.
Andrew Jones.
Good afternoon. Andrew Jones. I'm a property owner and resident in the historic district. And I appreciate the efforts of this group today to address issues going forward. But it must be said that while the city claims to support the historic district, its actions to date have focused on pushing through projects that hurt the district. Now, the NPS warned the city on page 52 of its 2018 report not to allow the destruction of the void between the principal buildings and lane structures in tithing blocks. So I know people have said that the NPS has not told us what to do. Yes, they told us what to do. It's on page 52. It even has a picture of a principal building, a courtyard, and a carriage house that is across the street, one block off from 336 Barner. They've told us, and they've told us in the letter that was delivered a couple of weeks ago that to preserve the lanes and streets means more than just the physical street or lane, that they must be retained so residents and visitors are able to identify all the features that compose the plan. In other words, a lane needs to look like a lane. It shouldn't begin with a mansion. Now, what everyone seems to forget here is that section 7.810G21B of the ordinance as currently written, so the ordinance that went through all the stakeholders, the public, that everybody approved of, prevents 336 Barner. It requires that the building have its entrance on the east-west street, and it couldn't. And because of that, there was a continuation. And so what happened? The city intervened. The city wasn't neutral. The city intervened on behalf of the developer. So the city took an affirmative action to hurt the district. And they issued a zoning determination, which is absolutely bizarre. It says it nullifies that provision of the law, wipes it out, by saying that if you cannot comply, then you're exempt. Not if you cannot comply, you can't build a building. If you cannot comply, you're exempt. Moreover, the city opened a pipeline for similar projects by applying that determination to all similarly situated buildings. So not just for 336, but for a pipeline, and the HDRB already approved another corner lot project at 301 West York Street. Now that the NPS has intervened, the city is creating through this meeting certainly the appearance of facilitating a solution to the problem, but the problem is the one the city just created. Be aware, none of the proposals we discussed today are going to take effect tomorrow. The damage is ongoing, and the city is free right now to push through more of these projects that are going to result in the district reaching emergency status. Now, there is one course of action that the city can take immediately, if in fact it is acting in good faith. It can revoke that determination and apply the existing law exactly as it is written. Instead, the city is again intervening by blocking and or opposing the four appeals from concerned residents. The city already blocked the first appeal without any discussions with me, the appellant. It did so just in time for the September 14th HDBR meeting where they approved 336 Barner partly on the basis that the city had withdrawn the appeal. Instead of attacking the preservationists and their appeals, the city should undo the damage unnecessarily caused and revoke the erroneous determination. And after the revocation, we need to address the city's authority to use a zoning determination to exempt favored parties from the law. If we do not, then this meeting is simply a waste of time. If I have a quick minutes, just as a matter of clarification, There's the Oglethorpe plan. You can see an accessory building. Its main entrance faces the courtyard because, of course, it supports the main building. Now, it may have some other secondary entrances, but the main entrance faces the courtyard. So we do know this. And also keep in mind that there's no differentiation of corner lots in the Oglethorpe plan. All tithing lots are treated the same. Thank you very much.
Paul Clement. Paul Clement.
Cobay. Paul Cobay. I live at 531 East Perry Street, which, by the way, is a tithing block subject to subdivision. I fully support the DNA's plan. I think that the National Park Service letter was a wake-up call. And I think that the cultural survey that's been suggested is a positive thing that needs to happen. Perhaps the HSF suggestion for education can begin that process. That's all I've got.
Melanie Miranda, did I say that right? Okay.
Thank you for having me. I am a property owner at 350 Barnard, so right down the street. And I'm not going to talk about the tithing lots or anything else because there's lots of experts here who have done a very good job. I'm going to talk about the garbage. The lanes are used for the garbage. And the way that this street is set up, and it has had some aberrations with different things, but there's probably, we need space for about 16 to 18 trash cans for the four houses that are right along Barnard Street. And this project is, I don't think they're going to want, right now the trash cans are along that building that's going to be torn down. I don't think the $4 million house is going to want trash cans going alongside their house. And so I just think this is something that the city needs to look at, is where are you going to put the trash cans? And this affects the Downtown Neighborhood Association and the historic things. Do we want the trash cans on Barnard Street? Do we want them on Charlton Street? Because there is a very big thing. So anyways, I just hope that that comes in. It's a small thing, but what happens is these projects go through and then all of a sudden people go, oh yeah, the trash cans, where are we going to put all of them? So thank you very much.
Susan Arden Jolly.
Thank you for having us today. I am Susan Arden Jolly, and I am actually here representing a group of people who have newly formed what we are calling the Oglethorpe Plan Coalition. And I was very pleased to hear how much consensus there was for us to be studying and adhering to that plan. I would just like to make everyone and the neighbors with whom I have great sympathy, because at one time I lived on Pulaski Square. And I must say that this Barnard Street project has gone forward is what is really the catalyst for so many of us joining together now, watching this and saying, how could this happen in such a pristine and pure classical area? It's hard to understand. But very, very briefly, to make you aware, the newly formed Oglethorpe Plan Coalition is dedicated to preserving and restoring the Oglethorpe Plan in Savannah, Georgia. Our principles, the design principles, as most of you know, of the Oglethorpe Plan are manifested in the 1734 Peter Gordon map. And I will read these principles very quickly, but you will notice how many of them are violated in the Barnard Street project. All buildings and tithing blocks face the east-west street without any exceptions. The original plan shows one lane building in a tithing block. Importantly, that building is subordinate to the main structure, separated from the main structure by a courtyard, has its main entrance facing the principal building, not the north-south street, what we've been hearing about already. There is no building in a tithing block that faces a north-south street. The plan does not treat corner lots on tithing blocks any differently from mid-block lots. The standards. To sustain the above principles, we agree with the following existing and proposed rules in the City of Savannah Code of Ordinances for new construction and additions, again cited by Mr. Jones earlier, as required by 7810G21B. No building in a tithing lot may have its principal entrance on a north-south street. In that regard, the city must revoke zoning determination 22-003805. And to protect the integrity of the lanes, any portion of a structure within 20 feet of a lane must be 25 feet in height or less. And that has been discussed today. The void between a principal building and the secondary building on a lane must be protected. No portion of a principal building is permitted to abut a lane. Now, we affirm section 7810AI, which requires that, quotation, development shall preserve or reconstruct the historic ward pattern of streets and lanes within the Oglethorpe Plan area, end quotation. We agree with the view of the National Park Service that, quotation, to maintain the NHL integrity of the district, the discernibility of the plan must be retained so residents and visitors are able to identify all the features that compose the Savannah Town Plan, elements that include the trust lots, tithing blocks, squares, streets, and lanes. And we very adamantly reject the anything goes version of the Oglethorpe Plan, which is the view that the Oglethorpe Plan includes all the structures that are inconsistent with the original plan and that such aberrations justify the proliferation of more aberrations. And with that, I will make space for someone else. Thank you.
Lorraine Benton. Susan Atkinson.
Atkinson, 301 East Charlton. I'm just taking this opportunity because I'm here just to speak. I'm not prepared with a speech. I don't know enough yet to speak as eloquently as those before me, but I want to take this time to say a few things that have came to mind. I'd first greatly appreciate everyone who volunteers and works for Savannah, because I don't know how you do it. It's a lot of work and commitment, and I mean that sincerely, and I hope I can start contributing more to our city. My first concern was is how, and I think we're addressing this, is how to get something in place so that we, the variances and the rules, that we don't, that we ensure that we have the things in place that we don't have to worry as residents that things are getting underneath. If it's so clear and tight, we don't have to watch, and it saves a lot of this discussion and heartache. Secondly, that I wanted to say, take with a grain of salt surveys, because in my experience, I find that surveys can lead you down a way when you don't know the whole picture, and you end up at the end agreeing to things or expressing opinions in something you had no intention of doing because you're just kind of guided along. So just be careful about surveys. Three is I wondered when we're discussing the language for subdivision, if it could be something, does it have to be so specific? Whereas if they, meet the criteria, can it just be that they are allowed to subdivide if they meet the criteria? And then if it's allowed to subdivide, but not granted, then we go from there and base it on other criteria like neighborhood input or a visual input, and to make sure that anybody who's finally approving these things actually visually go see the neighborhood. The group goes down, I know somebody does, but just have an overall picture of the impact of what you're agreeing to and how it would have an impact into the neighborhood and to the other communities. The lanes and garbage, I agree with, but not just that specific part. I was wondering if we could address, from my understanding, the city requires every unit to have garbage cans. For instance, I have a carriage house that I rent out, and I wanted to have one trash can for my house and the carriage house, but I was not allowed. And I thought if we could erase that, because they're requiring every apartment and every subject to, we don't have a choice. And I'd rather reduce the garbage cans in the lane, and also maybe have some kind of beautification project where, like New York City or Brooklyn, where they have bricks and mortar that contain the unit, and it doesn't look as cluttered and as unattractive as they do now with this. And finally, I want to say to the gentleman that called in about the Black communities to be saved and preserved, I really agree with that, because I think that's one thing I've noticed. I grew up in Savannah, is that what I love about it is this, and I've said this before, is this a real blend of all things. It's a blend of low, middle, and high income residential areas. It's a blend of commercial. It's a blend of industrial. That's what makes us unique. And if everything becomes too homogeneous, it loses its charm and character and livability. And we all, the city is composed of everybody different. And that's what makes us special. And I hope we take time to preserve all parts of the good parts of Savannah. Thank you.
Virginia Rand? Ron? Sorry. No? Okay, Kathy Levine.
Good afternoon. Kathy Levine, resident of the downtown Landmark District. I was just going to say, reiterate that I think historic preservation commissions are the best equipped to evaluate the appropriateness of subdivisions, as well as assemblage of lots, which I guess they're calling recombination of lots, in the historic districts, because they should take into consideration all the factors in the historic context in which the open spaces are developed. Commissions, not individuals, should determine whether a when developed the subdivision or the assemblage is in the public interest. I ask now, I don't know what the process would be. Could the MPC or could City Council implement an immediate moratorium in place on subdivisions? Is that possible? I mean, because now that it's in the know, I mean, would people continue?
Bridget, you want to answer that? Can the city implement a more emergency legislation now?
I think the short answer is yes, they could. That would be something for the mayor and aldermen to consider.
And how do you go about that process?
I would say the way to go about that is to petition the city manager.
Okay. All right, terrific. And then I just have some forward thinking things that I'm hoping that maybe we can consider with the MPC. And this hits on other people's statements. Georgia law allows for the abandoned right-of-way parcels to be acquired. And this has happened, obviously, at Oglethorpe Lane, St. Julian off of Lincoln. And then also, you know, where the Cultural Arts Center is now located. I'm hoping that the MPC in the future can consider this abandoned right-of-way parcels, whether it be street or lane. They shouldn't, nor should a portion of that be acquired in any local or historic national district. And then I was also going to mention, maybe we can start looking, since this is, you know, sort of a forward thinking, about basements. I know you're laughing, but basement additions have become an issue in historic districts throughout the country. When you cannot go up, people go down. They either dig down under historic homes or they raise the house to accommodate a basement. You say it's impossible, but it's not, and nor is it cost prohibitive. There is an article on last week's Wall Street Journal that addresses that. There's a new menace stalking suburbia. Meet the McBasement. And it goes on to talk about it. And if I looked up other historic district ordinances, and they actually have regulations on basements, and I think we should consider that as well. So those are my three things.
Well, we are way out of time. We were going to 3:30 today for our first meeting. So do anybody want to go over anything else, or do we want to pick up at another one, or how would you like to proceed?
Yes. It appears that most of the people in this room are in violent agreement. So I do have a question for you and maybe some of your staff. What are the next steps that we could expect?
So our next step was to compile everything that you all have said, and then to present them as a response to the HGBR chairwoman who wrote the letter requesting the stakeholder meeting.
And then what about?
Shouldn't the results of what we've been discussing today go to the mayor and all?
They can, but the HDBR requested this meeting, so that's, we need to respond.
I specifically requested this meeting. So once we, I would think, because once ordinance changes are proposed, it has to go before the mayor and aldermen anyway.
Has a lot more steps.
Yes, so this is the first part of the process. So that will happen.
May I suggest, speaking for me, David, don't know how you feel about this, but we're not beholden to the city of Savannah in any way, shape, or form, or Chatham County. We're entirely private sector. I appreciate you calling this delightful meeting to happen, this elegant afternoon. I feel my organization would sign on to recommendations similar to what you outlined, and as private stakeholder organizations, we could sign on to a letter to the mayor, alderman, MPs, you know, to all appropriate parties. I would suggest, I mean, again, speaking for my organization, not anybody else, Ellen, if you wanted to circulate a draft as we've done before on matters like this, would love to sit down and, you know, I want to talk to some of our usual suspects that we've engaged, you know, in the past. On the more editorial side, I've heard really great comments here and frustrations, which, you know, to me make a whole bunch of sense of why people are frustrated. And forgive me, I'm not intimately aware of what happened in Barnard Street to the extent that all of you are, because you're the folks that are impacted. I do want to say on a philosophical level of be careful what you wish for. There's you know, it is not a zero sum game, but there is must be an understanding for every action. There is a reaction. There was and I don't argue the merits of any of this at all. So please don't take it out of context. But there was a gentleman that was talking about values, and more restrictions creates more values. And yes, of course, that's true. And in just a few minutes later, everybody applauded for that. And then a few minutes later, everybody applauded for the idea of more diversity downtown and how homogenous it was. You can't increase value and increase diversity at the same time. You will leave someone behind. You will leave a socioeconomic group behind. You've got to be very careful about how far you go into something if you value, in fact, both things. Sometimes things are mutually exclusive. Further, there was a suggestion just now, which makes a whole bunch of sense, is one individual person shouldn't be able to make a decision, a group or a commission should. Well, that will always be the case under this structure. It will always ultimately be up to the city council, always. And that is a commission of kind of 9 people who are going to make a decision whether we agree or we disagree. And there's no way to bind those folks to do something. You cannot bind a future council or even a present council. Every bit of law that exists related to zoning or use conditions or all of that is passed by the city council through a charter that's given by state government to that body. They don't have to abide by any of it. They don't. They absolutely do not have to abide by any of it. They can change it. They can change it as long as it's properly changed, a noticed meeting, a majority, 2 readings, they can change it. There's nothing we could ever write, no matter how much we want to, that would say the future people can't, or even that this council can't. So we should be aware of that. If you feel like they have violated the law, there are recourses for those individuals to seek the courts to require the city to abide by its own ordinances. If those ordinances were not properly changed, or they didn't go through the process necessary to make exceptions. But, you know, I do want to be clear that my family has lived in this community for more than 6 generations. I grew up in Atlanta. I've been here for 25 years, lived downtown for 20, and have seen a lot of change, some of it good, some of it, in my opinion, bad. We should be careful in the process more than anything, and recognize while the process may fit what we want or stop what we didn't want, it will have other reactions to it that may be contrary to what our greater goal is. So we must be thoughtful when we're dealing with the process in general. Sorry, that's a soapbox issue. But I would be happy to sign on to a letter with the things discussed today.
Thank you, Michael.
Anybody else have anything else they want to say today?
I would just like to say thank you to everybody who came out, and I know this was a lot of time, and I just, yeah, it's very refreshing, so thank you.
Yeah, I echo that. I was going to say the same thing. I appreciate everybody coming and speaking their piece.
And I would like to thank MPC and HDBR for arranging the meeting. Thank you so much, Leah.
Thank you.
And Ellie.
All right. Well, Edmund, I'm going to thank all of you for spending an entire afternoon doing this with us. We appreciate your input very much. Thank you.